In the first lecture of this series, I asked the question, what is philosophy? And I suggested that among those areas that philosophy concerns itself with was moral philosophy, the theory of right and wrong conduct. How do we know what is right and what is wrong? Does it matter to know right from wrong? And we shall, in the course of this series on moral philosophy, be looking at one or two very famous philosophers who made their own distinctive contributions, people like Plato and Hobbes and Kant and Mill and Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist. But I want to prefix looking at specific philosophers by asking the question, what are the issues that they are all concerned about? What is it that moral philosophy is actually directing itself towards? What, in fact, do we mean when we talk about morals? And I would suggest that you can divide what we are thinking of here into four basic sections, and I'll outline the four and then go over each one. First of all, it is to do with rules of behaviour. Secondly, it is to do with principles. Thirdly, it concerns itself with motives, how far motives, rather than consequences, are important. And finally, and underlying perhaps all these, the question as to what is a human being anyway. Now that's rather a lot of material to try and get into an hour, but I'll do what I can. So we go back, first of all, and I imagine that anybody listening to me now would have thought of this straight away. Perhaps it must be first to say that morals are to do with how we behave, the rules which decide our actions. Now, it may sound very simple to state that, but the moment we talk about rules, we enter into an area where all kinds of other considerations arise, about which there's no absolute consensus. For example, I state a moral, a person may make it a moral rule not to be aggressive or violent towards another person. But then you might have a situation in which that person is put into a situation where violence is being expressed. They're in the middle of somebody who's gone berserk, or in time of war, for example. Does this mean that this rule must be applied, the rule that we avoid violence or aggression, that we apply it in every conceivable situation? Now, some people might call themselves pacifists and say that that is so, that in no situation, not even in time of war, not even when an enemy nation invades one's own nation, not even then should one be prepared to answer the invader with violence. Others would say, no, at that point, we have to compromise our rule. We have to change it slightly, or say that in this circumstance, the rule does not apply. Well, this then means that we've got two particular ways of thinking. Either you say a rule is a rule and the rule remains absolute, or you say that it depends on the circumstances as to whether the rule should be applied or not. Now, to say that it remains absolute may sound clear-cut. Indeed, it is clear-cut. But supposing one finds that in one society, a particular rule is applied in one way, but in another society, it is applied in a completely different way. For example, in most of the Western world, I imagine the whole of the Western world, it is agreed that the union between the marriage or the forming of families whereby children are born should happen in a marriage of a man and a woman, one man, one woman, known as monogamy. Well, fair enough. But if you go to other societies, you will find that the practice sometimes is quite different. You get polygamy, which means a man having many wives, or you get polyandry, which is a woman having many husbands. Now, who's got the right rule? I've no doubt, and we haven't got time to go into this, that these practices suited the culture of the various communities which express them. But if you say that the rule is absolute, then somebody somewhere has got to stand up and say that two out of these three have got it wrong. And that raises problems, because then one can ask, well, on what basis do you say they've got it wrong? And the moment we start talking about moral rules as absolutes, we really do land ourselves in really quite deep water, because historically ideas have changed as to what a rule should be. Geographically, we've seen it may differ. And sometimes, of course, you can have two rules that will clash. I'll give you an example of two rules that are opposed to each other in one particular circumstance. The rule not to kill, that's a rule that most societies express as one of their basic codes of conduct, not to kill. I mean, the commandment, thou shalt not kill, in one form or another, is found in most philosophies and most religions and most cultures. But how do you apply that against the rule that a person should be free to decide what happens to their own bodies? That if something is going to happen to a person's body, that person should be free to decide that this should happen. Now you may say, well, how do these two rules clash? They clash when we come on to the moral issue of abortion. Because on the one hand, you have those who are opposed to abortion on the grounds that this is destroying at least a potential life. And on the other hand, those who believe that the woman who is pregnant should be free, because it is her body that is bearing the fetus, she should be free to decide what should become of it. So here, on abortion, you have a clash of rules. And, of course, one has got to give way. But if each rule proclaims itself to be absolute, i.e. there are no possible modifications to it that can be made, then you really got an enormous dilemma. How do you work that out? The absolutist who says, thou shalt not kill, and killing a fetus is killing. The absolutist who says each person is free to decide what should happen to their bodies. And this is an issue that many moral philosophers, not on that particular application of it, but the issue of how strong rules should be, is one that has bothered the minds of many philosophers. Today, there has been a movement away in philosophy and in society generally from this absolutist position towards the relativist position, in which basically the argument is that you have to work the best you can within the circumstances in which you are operating, taking into account the people who are involved, actual place where it is, what else is affecting the circumstance, which will vary from place to place, and so on. And this is called relativism. It's relative to the actual situation. You may have a rule in mind, but you're at all times prepared to modify the rule, or even sometimes to change the rule. Thus, for example, a pacifist may say that basically I am opposed to violence, but might be prepared, or should perhaps, if becomes a relativist, prepared to say that while I still keep the rule of non-violence, as far as is possible, in an act of war, that has, with great regret, temporarily to be laid aside. But that is no longer an absolute, of course. So there is this movement towards this greater flexibility in the application of rules where relativists are concerned. And, of course, you reach the ultimate stage in this kind of discussion where, in the end, there's no rule at all. It's called postmodernism. There are no absolutes and there are no basic rules. One just has to do the best one can in any situation one is in. And standards and norms and all the things associated with the absolute position are being rejected. Now, you may not like this, so you may say, bring back the times when somebody could speak with authority and everybody else listened to him or to her. Others will say, no, it is far better that people should be encouraged to think for themselves how they should behave, what rule they should follow in a particular situation. Critics to that may well say, well, that is allowing people to say, I'll do whatever I feel like doing, and that's it, and I'll make the case out that that is the right thing for this circumstance, but what I really mean is, it happens to suit my inclinations. All these issues come in, and the discussion as to whether rules are absolute or relative, and the implications of both of these, could take us a great deal of time. Anyway, that is the first issue, and you can see that it does have implications for many, if not all, of the forms of behaviour that we decide to adopt, or many of our moral decisions. But then we come on to principles, and here again we've got problems. Let's look first of all at the difference between principles and rules. A principle is the general underlying concern, the sort of ideal situation that one is aiming to bring about. Let's state one or two principles. I believe, shall we say, I state a principle here, that in relationships between human beings, benevolence or goodwill ought to be pursued. Another principle is that I think people should be free to decide what becomes of their lives. Nobody should dictate to others. Nobody should exploit others. People should be free and left free to choose what is to become of them. I think that people should be treated equally as far as that is humanly possible. I think in human affairs we should try to achieve the norm of justice. And justice is one of the great virtues as taught by Plato, who we should be looking at in a later lecture. Justice, fair play. These are all principles. They're very general. They sound noble. And in fact, they're the easiest things that a public speaker can turn to in order to get a round of applause. After all, any politician who says, I want to see more fair play, I want to see greater justice in society, I want to see people showing more goodwill to one another, I don't want to see man exploiting his fellow man, and so on, pronouncing all these marvellous principles, well, people will applaud him because it sounds great. But what a philosopher would say at this point is, what exactly has he said? Sounds good. But then he's hardly going to stand up and say, I believe in injustice in society. I don't think people should be treated equally. I don't want to see fair play at all. I don't want to see benevolence. I want to see malevolence operating in human lives. If he said that, he'd be shouted down. Nobody would listen to him. But, okay, let's follow this principle of benevolence. You see, so we can all say we want to be benevolent towards one another, but what does it mean in practice? How do you apply it in the real life terms, in the actual situations that we all face? How do you show benevolence as a parent? Well, there's a question. Two sets of parents. This is perfectly feasible. In fact, it happens over and over again. Two sets of parents bringing up their children. Each of them are trying to love or show benevolence to their children. But the way they do this, or the way they bring them up, could well differ. The rules of one household expressing the principle of benevolence could be quite different from the rules in another household. One household may, for example, have a very liberal regime, if I can use that word. In other words, that the children are given a great amount of freedom as to how they use their time and how they behave generally, when they should come in at night, and so on. Whereas another household, who if challenged would say, yes, we are trying to show love towards our children, may lay down a much firmer regimen, is the word, a much firmer order in the household, may make it very much more clear than in the first household the steps beyond which their children are not allowed to step, to go. They, in other words, that this is a much more rule-governed household than the first one. Now, I'm not going to discuss which is the preferable form of bringing up children. There is no point, because whatever I say, somebody else could well say something quite different. The point I'm making is that on the basis of the same principle, completely different forms of behaviour are being applied. And this is why principles tend to be a little bit confusing. I think we need principles. In fact, I'm certain we need principles. If we lose sight of them, then we are losing sight of the distant view, as it were, the ultimate aim that we have in mind, our ultimate goal. But principles will not help us to decide the rules. It's important to bear that in mind. The philosopher also would want to know, where do these principles arise? Why do we say that justice ought to be pursued? Let's just deal with that particular principle, justice or fair play. Why should things be fair? Certainly the case that if I had given to one of my children what was obviously a very expensive present for Christmas, and then to another child, one that was much cheaper, say, a small packet of pencils, it is quite likely that the one who received the pencils, looking at, what should we say, some mechanical toy that in a great big box, would say, well, that's not fair. I would say it quite certainly, and be prepared to be quite vituperative about it as well. Not fair. Well, all right, but where does this idea that things should be fair come from? Why is it that we feel, I think intuitively, that justice and fair play are very important in the running of society, and that if they're lost sight of, then we're going to have a bad time? But where does the idea come from in the first place? Nobody's taught my child that things should be fair. I mean, I could, if I did that, I suppose that would be my reply. Well, okay, it's not fair, but why should things be fair? Now, that would get an eyebrow raised in the eyes of a child. Why should things be fair? So, principles don't answer that kind of question, but they exist. We have these principles. It seems to me that the principles come to us almost in our genes, that we sense it without having to argue the case, that this particular principle is a valid one. We sense that we ought to be benevolent. We sense that freedom is better than being bound. We sense that justice is better than injustice. And we sense that equality towards other people is better than putting some people on ranking some people higher than others. We have this sense. Now, but what has produced this sense? And this brings on to a very big issue in philosophy, which is the question of whether our principles come from above, from God, or whether they've come through our genetic structure, in other words, our biological past. And that will be an issue that we shall look at in a later lecture, but I think I can say enough now that this is a great divide among many philosophers. That some say the only explanation we can give for this intuitive sense of these principles is that they are handed down to us by God, who is a moral God. And when we come on to Immanuel Kant, as we shall later on in another lecture, that was his great affirmation, that our moral sense, our moral principles, are the result of the presence of God in our midst, God who is a moral God. One might almost say he is the essence of morality. God is morality, Kant was arguing. But then, on the other hand, you have this whole evolutionary theory and the idea that our morals have come as a result of adaptation to our environment. And that what Darwin said in his Origin of Species was that, Ascent of Man, Ascent of Woman, isn't it? That the two different books. Anyway, he argues that over many generations, human beings have discovered that certain principles or certain general ideas about society and how it should be run have gradually been found to be more life-enhancing than their opposites. Thus, communities are more likely to adhere together if there is some esprit de corps, if there is some goodwill between its different members. And that kind of society, when challenged by another tribe, shall we say, because it has learned to work together and live more harmoniously together, is more likely to cohere in battle than one where each person is at everybody else's throats. And so, over many generations, it has become almost part of our bloodstream that we sense this. And the same with justice, that if you have a society in which there is injustice, then sooner or later, members of that society will rebel against this and will, therefore, again, be not in a position to cohere when challenged. And that these principles, therefore, are what, through trial and error, human beings over many generations, thousands of years, have discovered to actually work in preserving a particular society. Now, there's a big difference here between that view, which I call principles coming from below, i.e. through biology, and the view that principles come from above, primarily meaning that they come from this divine being who is the essence of morality. And that is an issue that would have to be discussed if you were going to study moral philosophy at greater length. So that is the second of these areas. We have moral rules, moral principles, and they are quite distinct, even though in the end we try to show that one is linked with another. The third one is motives. If a person does something that is going to be beneficial to the community, but does so for, shall we say, a selfish reason, his motive is totally selfish, does that actually matter? Perhaps I can give you an example. I won't tell you the town it was in, but what I'm telling you is actual a fact. I'll keep the town quiet. Some years ago, a wealthy industrialist in a particular town offered to the general hospital in the town enough money, millions of pounds, to build a totally new ward. His only condition being that the ward should be named after him, and his name should be there boldly displayed. Now, you may say, well, that's all right, why not? But the point is that this industrialist was the most hated figure in that town and in the community. He brought employment to people, but at a cost. He paid the minimum wages. At a time when the trade unions were strong, he refused to allow trade unionism among his workers. He hired and fired at will. He was a total dictator. And his name in that town and in that area was that of a totally selfish individual whose whole purpose in life was to make his own nest comfortable and not care two hoots about anybody else who was dependent upon him. He was absolutely loathed. So we've got now a man who must have been clever enough, astute enough to be aware of this, who wanted history to have a very different image of him, the man who gave the money for this ward in this hospital, and to make sure that in future years he should not, this deed of his should not be forgotten, his name is to be there boldly displayed. And members of this hospital were on a course that I was running. I was talking about medical ethics on that course, and they said what a tremendous. They hadn't resolved the situation at the time they came on this course. What a tremendous dilemma this was. It'd be interesting to know what you would do about it. The point is, of course, what, looking at it now from the point of view of the philosophical issue that's involved, the motive was simply his names being made emblazoned, as it were, for the future. His motive was self-aggrandizement. But the outcome would be that the hospital would have a new, much necessary ward, and would be therefore better equipped to deal with the physical and perhaps mental needs of the people in the area. So you've got a situation there where the motive is bad, but the outcome is good. You could have the opposite, of course. I read in the papers of this should be a couple of years back, of some chap who was standing at the end of a pier in a seaside town on a stormy day at high tide and saw what he took to be somebody who had fallen into the water and was thrashing about. Obviously, to him, it seemed to be in great difficulty. Now, he couldn't swim, this man on the pier, but apparently without any thought for his own safety, he dived into the water to save this person whom he thought was in difficulties. And what happened was that he dragged this person along with himself to the depth, and they were both drowned. It came out in the end that the person was a member of the local swimming club who had deliberately come out into the sea when this was chopping in order to strengthen his muscles and to, in other words, to train. But this heavy man suddenly coming down on top of him finished him. Now, the outcome of that was bad. Two people drowned. But how does one assess the deed? The man who couldn't swim, with no thought for his own life, no thought about his own safety, who jumped in to save a person whom he genuinely, however misguidedly, genuinely believed to be a fellow human being in difficulties, did just that. And one hears in the floods we've had recent times of people jumping into the water and drowning in an attempt to save their pet dog. What kind of moral decision, what kind of assessment, rather, does one make on this, where the motive is good, but the outcome is bad? And this is, therefore, it becomes very convoluted when you start bringing motives into it. And when we turn, as we shall, to look at John Stuart Mill and the utilitarians, we'll see how he looks at consequences more than motives, whereas Kant looks at motives more than consequences. That's an issue for you to decide. And so we come on to the fourth one, which is certainly will be the longest issue that I want to look at, which is theories of a human being. What is a human being? After all, how we think people should behave is inevitably going to be tied up, to a certain extent, with what we think a human being actually is. And in this, there have been a large number of theories, but I think they boil down in the end to four. Although you can get a book by an Oxford professor, L. Leslie Stevenson, originally entitled Seven Theories of Human Nature. I think it's extended it since in a later edition to 10 theories, either 9 or 10 anyway. But I think that in the end, there are four basic theories of what a human being is. And remember, what we're looking at this in order to see how much it helps us to decide how we should behave towards other people. And the first one, the first theory, which is very much linked with Plato, and we shall look at this in much more detail in the next lecture. The first theory is that we are, each of us, a combination of a physical material body and a spiritual immaterial soul, or psyche, as the Greek word has it. This is known as dualism, dualism, each person has two essences, the material essence and the spiritual essence. And Plato enlarged on this and suggested that, in fact, the whole purpose in life is to develop the psyche, the soul, and not to spend our time responding only to the demands of the body, since the body will itself ultimately decay. And the soul, he argued, would then return at the death of the body to be recharged. And we look at this in much more detail when we come on to Plato, and then return reincarnated in another body. And this same concept is found in Hinduism. Hindus believe that we possess what they call the Atman, A-T-M-A-N, and that this Atman is the essential self, of which many people are unaware as they live their lives, but that the person who's had his or her eyes opened, who's achieved enlightenment, becomes aware of this, and aware also, as with Plato, that a life spent satisfying only the needs of the body is missing out on the main aim. And therefore, when we are dealing with other human beings, we should bear in mind that each other person, if this is the view, is a representative of the soul as well as what we see physically before us. That person has, and on this theory, an immortal part, an immortal essence, and we should acknowledge that. And now you may say, well, how does this affect morals? Well, if we go back to the abortion debate, a lot of discussion on that as to whether we are, when killing a fetus, killing not just something physical, but destroying a human soul. And the concept of the soul does, in fact, enter into many of the issues that confront anybody who has to make any kind of moral decision, that we're not just dealing with the physical body, but we're dealing with the soul. In the time of the Reformation, when Catholics and Protestants were liberally killing one another for the sake of their faiths, the argument that was presented on both sides was this, that if you live in, as they believed it, a state of heresy for any longer, your soul will be that much more warped, and your time in purgatory will be that much longer. Therefore, by killing you now, we are really doing you a good turn, because you're a lot less time to build up the wickedness of being in a state of error. Now, you may say, well, that's Middle Ages, people don't talk like that anymore. Far from it, they certainly do. Not very long ago, just before, in fact, the time when the Soviet Union collapsed, I was arguing with a very devout religious person about the rights and wrongs of nuclear war. And his argument was this, that we should, the moral thing to do, he said, is to drop nuclear weapons on the Soviet Union in order, precisely for the point that I just made, they are living in error, they're living as atheists, they are building up sin in their lives, so that their time in purgatory, the longer they live, is going to be all that much longer. And we will be doing the Russians, he argued, a great good turn by destroying them, by destroying their bodies, because their souls will not be destroyed. Their souls will have that much less evil in them as a result of being killed earlier by our intervention. And this guy, who was an intelligent guy, he was the head of his department in a school, genuinely believed that that was the case. What you do to a person's body doesn't matter. You have to consider all the time the person's soul. So this what sounds like to do more to do with metaphysics than with morals, in fact has a very direct implication for the way that we make up our minds about what is right and what is wrong. So that is the first of the theories of what a human being is. The second is what I would call the theistic theory, that is to say, the theory expressed in Christianity and in Judaism and in Islam, which is that we are creatures of God. We are made by God, and therefore, because of that, our moral lives should be lived in accordance with his will. So that moral decision-making in all these three religions becomes a matter of finding out what is God's will for us and then obeying it, performing God's will as far as we possibly can. Thy will, not mine, be done, could stand as the central moral text for a theist, a member of any of these religions. It's different from the earlier one because it brings in the ultimate authority of God, this theory of human nature. See, if you believe with Plato that the soul is immortal, then God is really superfluous to requirements. Plato mentions the gods from time to time, but they don't play any great part in his thinking. If you know that you're immortal, you know that you're going to be reincarnated, then you don't really need to know what is the will of God, because your soul will carry on anyhow. Whereas in the theistic religions, the belief is that life beyond death is available, but on certain terms, on God's terms, not as a natural consequence of having an immortal soul. If we are to survive death in any form, it'll be because God has decided it and not us. So all the time, this view of morals is that of an obedient servant rather than an autonomous human being. Now, some religious people might feel this is being too strong, but I would suggest that in the end, that this is what it is. To be religious, ultimately, is to discover and then perform the will of God, which you may say is a perfectly acceptable thing. I'm not making any value judgment. In a later lecture, I want to look at this in much more detail, particularly on the question as to how we discover the will of God and why it is that so many different people come to different ideas, different conclusions about what exactly God's will is. That is a problem in itself. At the moment, I'm just thinking of this in relation to our moral decisions, that we do things not necessarily because we want to do them, though that may sometimes come into it, but basically, when we make our moral decisions, we do so as a result of exploring what is God's will and concluding that this is in fact the case and then doing it. And you do find that therefore that those devout followers of these religions tend to be more self-controlled in their expression of their own feelings and emotions. In general, this is the case, that they feel that they are under orders, so to speak. And therefore, the idea that anything goes would be alien to them. Anything doesn't go. Anything goes only if it is in accordance with the will of God as they understand it. And therefore, there's a sense of duty about this approach to what a human being is, which is not to be found, I think, in the others. So that is the second one. The first one, then, the dualistic theory. The second one, the theory of a human being as God's creation, and therefore as God's servant, or God's looking to God as the leader and father who must be obeyed. The third theory has got many forms. It is really the theory that a human being, the way he behaves, is not free to choose. That we're all following certain forces which put us into a particular groove, even a straitjacket. So that really, we may think that we are choosing between one way of behaviour and another, when in fact we're not. The absolute determinist would say that there is nothing we do which is freely chosen, that everything we do, even our thoughts, are the consequence of what has gone before. And that an idea that I have now is a result of activity in my brain a moment before, and that this is all going on in with an inexorable process. Similarly, my behaviour is the consequence of what I've done before that and what has happened to me before that. So although inside my head I may think I am making a free decision in the sense that I could have done otherwise, in fact, so say the determinists, we are deluding ourselves. At no point could we have done otherwise. We could only have done otherwise if what had happened before that decision was taken had been otherwise. Granted that what had happened up to the point when we made that decision, the decision we actually made was inevitable. Now, that is full-blooded determinism. And it raises the question, if that is the case, for this is the question anybody interested in morals, as I am, must ask. If that is the case, then how can one possibly blame anybody for the way he behaves? After all, if he's only doing what he's done because of what has gone before, all right, well, you might say, well, what he did before, let's blame him for that. But then what he did before is the consequence of what happened to him or what he did before that, and so on. And you can take that right back to the moment of his conception, if you like. And it does make of us automatons who are just following a preset pattern at which in which there is no choice, and therefore there can be no blame, and for that matter, no praise. After all, if we only a person who does something very brave, very self-sacrificial, all the sort of things that people do which get noted and for which they're congratulated, why congratulate them? Why congratulate a man who's risked his life to save somebody else? I mean, he couldn't have, granted what went before, he could not have done anything else. So both on the plus scale and on the minus scale, I think the natural outcome of taking a full blown, a total position on this, so that everything is determined, makes it difficult to make any kind of moral judgment about anybody. There are, of course, modifications in the absolute determinism, and perhaps I can bring this point to a conclusion by mentioning some of these. There's one other point, the fourth theory of human nature I want to come on to, but we've got time just to look at one or two of the modified expressions of determinism. You have the what is known as historical or sociological determinism, associated with Karl Marx, Marxian thought, who argued that there were movements within society and within history which were inexorable. They were determined. That people are caught up in movements where maybe the individual may be able to stand out against the movement, but nothing will stop that movement from going in the direction it is going. It's rather like a swing at a time of a general election. You take a Gallup poll of a part of the country and you find that, shall we say, there is a swing of 5% from one party to another. And the strange thing is that you then find that when it's reflected in the general election, that is shown all over the country. Sometimes the swing is in a poll is slightly different, but all over the country the same kind of swing happens. And at the last election, for example, when there was in 1997, when there was a swing to Labour, there were very few constituencies in which that did not happen. It seems to have happened nationally, the swing. You can't fight the swing, one candidate was told after he'd been defeated, much to his chagrin. Another
sociological factor in this is suicides. Now, I'm giving this lecture not very far from the not very far from the Clifton Suspension Bridge. I'm actually over on the other side of the water, but the Clifton Suspension Bridge is a noted spot for suicides. I don't know what the number is for each year for people who jump off the suspension bridge, but the number is pretty well constant. Let us say, for the sake of the argument, that 100 people a year jump off this. I don't know whether this number is right. Perhaps before I gave this lecture I should have found out. It doesn't matter. The point I'm making is valid. Let us say that 100 people every year, two a week, jump off the Clifton Suspension Bridge, and that in this year now, and I'm giving this lecture at the beginning of the year 2001, that in the year 2001 100 people will jump off it. That we can be certain about, or as near as to certain, as, apart from perhaps one or two different either way. But it's not saying that I'm not saying that I'm going to name now who these 100 people are. This is how Marx was to describe the determinism within society, that there are certain fixed trends within society, a trend which does produce X number of suicides every year, and that this is going to go on, and there's nothing the individual can do to stop it. So that is a modified form of determinism. It does mean that when you are in a society, you may do your best not to take absorb the values of that society into your own system, but you're going to have to fight very hard indeed to do it, because when you are part of a community, you tend to get caught up in the community values, and that is known as sociological determinism. It's very difficult to deny, but the point that the opponent of determinism would say is that even though it's saying what happens in general, it does not say that any individual is not free to turn against the trends. Otherwise, in a cannibalistic society, how do you account for the person who first stood up and said, eating people is wrong? There, another modified form of determinism is religious determinism. It's called predestination, and it's linked with two particular names in Christian ethics or Christian morals. St. Augustine, who lived a millennium and a half ago, and John Calvin, who lived half a millennium ago. John Calvin, the founder of the Presbyterian Church. And their argument was that since God was all-knowing, omniscient, he knew the past, the present, and the future. After all, if he only knows the past and the present, he doesn't know more than, really, the most brilliant of human beings could know, or a computer could know. But the future, he also must know, if he has got perfect wisdom. And if he knows the future, then he knows what our, your and my, eternal destinies are. In very basic terminology of the theistic religions, he knows whether we're destined for heaven or for hell. And if he knows that that is the case, then it means that the situation is fixed. And therefore, logically, our eternal destiny is already decided, because God knows. Now, it's difficult to refute the logic of that. It's just the fact that, of course, it does seem, therefore, to take away the responsibility, because if that is how God knows it to be, then it does seem to suggest that God is in some way responsible and has made certain people destined for damnation, which seems a strange thing for a God who is ostensibly a God of love to do. And it's only fair to say that the vast bulk of the Christian church have turned against this concept of predestination. But it is still strong in certain communities. And I've lived in a Presbyterian community with Presbyterians who really believed this, that they were among the elect, as they describe themselves. And being so made them feel that they were certain, absolutely certain, of their future hopes being fulfilled in the future.
certainly gave them a certain confidence, sometimes a little bit overbearing confidence, but there it is. However, it does seem to take away too much of human responsibility from us human beings, and as I say, most of the church has rejected that. Another modified form of determinism is psychological determinism, particularly that of Sigmund Freud. He talked about people who express what he called neuroses or psychoses, rather irrational behaviour, which couldn't be explained except by his form of psychoanalysis, which meant going back beyond the conscious mind to what he called the unconscious, going back into those things that had happened, which were stored in deep in our brains, in our minds, things that had happened in the past, which had affected us greatly then and had been shoved, as it were, down below the surface into the unconscious mind, forgotten but not lost. That's the point about Freud. Nothing is ever lost. Nothing has ever happened to us. And he argued that people who showed these irrational symptoms needed to be taken back through deep psychoanalysis, which is really just getting people to explore their own minds gradually, maybe over many years, until they came to the point where this occurred and they could bring it to the surface and know why it is they were behaving in this particularly strange way. And Freud spent a lot of time with people who had these neuroses, and he was quite certain that this was the way through. And he said that of one particular woman, whom he called Anna O, that she was determined by her unconscious mind. And we have the phrase, a Freudian lapse, where we say something we hadn't intended to say, but sort of comes out of the back of our mind somehow. And Freud said that these lapses usually reveal what we really mean to say rather than what we actually say, because what we actually say may be being polite, whereas the lapse may be saying what we really think of somebody else. So the slip of the tongue. There's no such thing as a slip of the tongue, according to Freud. It all comes out of the unconscious. Well, there is that, but many others have argued that we can overcome the unconscious by building on it, and this is a big debate in psychological circles today. However, there are those who really believe that we are determined by what is going on, unknown to us, in the secret parts of our minds. We can mention one other, that the determinism expressed by the behaviorists, as they were called, the most famous of whom was called B.F. Skinner, who argued that we are made by our actual physical surroundings. Put people in dingy surroundings, he said, and they will behave dingily and gingerly, not dingily, not gingerly, perhaps gingerly as well. Put people in that kind of surrounding and that's how they behave. Put people in pleasant surroundings and they'll behave differently. And he therefore argued that the best way to cut out crime in slum areas, for example, was to put people in better accommodation. Well, that's an issue that you can debate, how far people do change their lifestyles because their surroundings are more pleasant. There may be a point, but clearly, however true it is not absolute, in the sense that you could say that the way to get rid of all crime, therefore, is to change the sociological conditions in which people live. Anyway, that's four examples of a modified type of determinism. But we come on now, and I want to finish this lecture by mentioning a school of thought that we shall be spending a whole lecture on, and therefore I'll just very quickly mention it now. The school which turns completely against the idea that we are determined. It doesn't say we are completely free. It doesn't deny the fact that gravity, we are affected by the laws of gravity, and that certain physical things have physical effects on us, and perhaps even mental effects on us. That there are certain conditions of living which we have to follow willy-nilly. But that nonetheless, when we're making up of our minds how we should behave, which is what we're concerned with in this lecture, we are free to choose. Now, the school of thought that I'm talking about is the existentialists, a difficult name, not a very fluent or felicitous name, but nonetheless a school of thought that has had a great influence on Western thinking in particular in recent decades. And basically, the famous existentialists are the most recent Jean-Paul Sartre, before him Martin Heidegger. Jean-Paul Sartre was French, Martin Heidegger German.
Before him was Friedrich Nietzsche, also German. And before him, and known as the father of modern existentialism, the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. And the theme of the existentialists is that a human being, the question we're asking, what is a human being, what is human nature, is the wrong sort of question, because it suggests that there is a fixed nature in every one of us, and that the dualistic view and the child of God or servant of God view and the determined view all try to put every human being into the same kind of straitjacket. And existentialism will have nothing to do with this. Existentialism argues that we are, each of us, in the process of making ourselves, our natures, as we go along, that by the choices we make, by the priorities we establish in our lives, by the way we spend our time, by the way we spend our money, by the people we associate with, by the ideas that we sort of take on board, by all these things, all of which we do freely, we are building up the person that each one of us is. And that therefore the idea that we should be guided by a God out there, or by a government out there, that there are any powers out there that are going to put us in the path that they want us to go, if we do not accept that, then we are going against our basic selves, and that therefore we must show our autonomy. That's the word they use, the existentialists, that we are autonomous. We are born to make our... Autonomous literally means one's a law unto oneself. Now, I know that has a bad connotation. He's a law unto himself. It means he doesn't give a damn what other people do. He's going to do this. It doesn't mean that. It means that if I decide I am going to act in a particular way, it may be that I'm following a way that many others also follow, but it is not because others follow it that I'm doing it. I'm doing it because I have weighed up the consequences for myself. I've weighed up the circumstances. And I have come to the conclusion that this is the way for me. And I'm certainly not going to follow the crowd just because the crowd is going that way. My life, if I'm an existentialist, will not be guided by what the headlines say in the papers, or what people say loudly on television, or what other people shout from their pulpits or their soapboxes or anybody else, anywhere else. I will be my own person, making my own way through life, establishing my own priorities in life, and working according to them. And this is the latest theory of human nature to arrive on the scene. And I would argue that it is, in fact, one that links up very closely with many of the ideas in the Eastern religions, which I've talked about in another series, that we are not dependent for our purposiveness in life, for the moral decisions we make, on rules and regulations that have been handed down to us. We can take them into account. Indeed, we can ask for people's advice. But in the end, it is us, each of us, who decides whether that advice we shall be taken, or even who we shall go to in the first place to seek that advice. Well, those are the four areas which I think moral philosophy covers. I asked the question earlier on, is it important to be moral? Why be moral? I would simply say, as my last word, that to be alive is to be moral. You cannot avoid making moral decisions. And therefore, the philosopher says, since you can't avoid them, why not think them through? Why not, in other words, before you make them, put your mind in gear?